Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
At National Bank, we're here to level up your reality.
Does that mean I can move from my parents' basement into my own apartment?
It's possible. We can even help you swap your backyard for a travel destination of your choice.
And if I wanted to buy my first car?
Sure. Let's see what we can do for you. We're here to level up your reality. National Bank.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Sunday, the 4th of June. Officials in India are examining whether a signalling error led to the train crash which killed 288 people. Three Israeli soldiers and an Egyptian are killed near the border, but was it a mistake? And as fighting continues in Sudan, we hear about the threat to the treasures in the National Museum. Also in the podcast, it got off to a very fast start, but who won the first All-Manchester FA Cup final? And
Burna Boy, who's the first African artist to sell out a stadium here in the UK.
Afrobeats, taking the world by storm. The crash involving three trains in eastern India on Friday evening is now officially the third most deadly on India's railways, with 288 dead. Preliminary investigations suggest an error with signalling may have been to blame, and inquiries looking into a theory that an express train was diverted onto a loop line where it smashed into a stationary goods train. Its carriages derailed and were then hit by a second passenger train. One survivor described the scene as a bloodbath on the tracks. Among the many people caught up in it were two brothers. One survived, the other is missing. His desperate father and brother have been looking for him.
I need help to trace my son. I had never thought that this could ever happen. I am restless. I would prefer to die if I didn't trace my son.
My brother was sitting on a window seat just next to me. Suddenly there was a sound of a bomb blast, like a big bang. All the rubble came inside from windows and lights went off. It was all dark. And the train turned upside down. I fell on a pile of people. And many others fell on me. I somehow managed to come out.
Well, on Saturday evening, more than a day after the crash, I got the latest from our correspondent at the scene, Archana Shukla.
Well, we are at the accident site, and behind me you can see the wreckage of the three trains that collided last evening. More than 26 hours, the rescue operations have been ongoing. As we understand, most people who were trapped have been pulled out from the wreckage, and now the maintenance work on the tracks to get these tracks back online is ongoing so that the train services that have been disrupted go online. But the signs since afternoon when we came here have not been one that you would want to be and see here. Passenger families have been scouting for their loved ones, for their relatives, many of them not even knowing which hospital they have been sent to. More than 288 casualties have been reported. That's the official figure. 1,175 people have been injured so far, according to the official number declared in the evening. And this is the scale of the train crash that India has not seen in many decades. It's one of the deadliest. And there are many questions being raised here on how really three trains collided. There are multiple scenarios being worked out. There are conflicting versions of how the three trains collided and led up to a pileup. We were in the biggest hospital here in the state, in the city of Cuttack, which is about 3 hours' drive from this side, where all the critically injured passengers were being taken. Every 30 minutes, an ambulance coming into the hospital, ferrying in these critically injured passengers. Passenger families really distressed, lost hopes. This wreckage really just begs a lot of questions that the Indian government and the Central Railway Ministry will need to answer.
Archana Shukla at the site of the crash. Well, earlier, the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi visited the scene and promised to bring anyone responsible for the accident to justice. But there have long been safety concerns about Indian railways, and experts believe the government will be under more pressure to deal with them. Yogitila Mai reports.
Cranes and other machines are being used to clear the wreckage off the crash, strewn across miles of tracks in Balasore. Some railway workers have told the BBC that the Coromandel Express, going from Kolkata in the east to the southern city of Chennai, collided with a stationary freight train on the same track. Its coaches then overturned and were hit by another passenger train coming in the opposite direction. But officials dispute this, saying all three trains were on different tracks and they're still investigating why the Coromandel Express derailed. Narendra Modi visited the site of the accident and a hospital treating the injured, where he promised action. This is an extremely serious incident, he said. I've ordered an inquiry into every detail. Whoever is found guilty will be given stringent punishment. They won't be spared. Despite the Prime Minister's words, there will be questions for the government too. It's invested heavily to modernise its rail network. But after this crash, many are now asking if safety has been the main priority.
Yogita Lamai in India. Three Israeli soldiers and an Egyptian policeman have been killed in an unusual incident on their shared border. Israel says the Egyptian shot dead two Israelis in the early morning before being killed along with the third Israeli soldier in a gunfight. Egypt said the deaths occurred after the Egyptian officer had crossed into Israel in pursuit of smugglers. Israel and Egypt signed a peace deal in 1979, but there have been occasional incidents on the border involving militants or smugglers. Our correspondent in Cairo, Sally Nabil, told me what was known.
From the Egyptian side, there was a statement issued by the spokesman of the army. He has put this whole incident in the context of chasing a group of drug smugglers. The statement said that an Egyptian security personnel was pursuing a group of drug smugglers and he crossed into the Israeli side of the border and there was an exchange of fire where three Israeli soldiers were killed, two others were injured, and the Egyptian security personnel himself lost his life in the crossfire. But there were a lot of criticism directed to the Egyptian army because that statement came after many hours. And it's worth mentioning that this is a very rare incident to take place across the Israeli-Egyptian borders because since Egypt signed a peace treaty with Israel more than 40 years ago, the borders have been relatively quiet.
So are they saying that the Israelis and the Egyptian were killed by drug smugglers, or was it a case of mistaken identity as the two sides exchanged fire?
Actually, there are many unanswered questions in this incident, and many people on social media are saying that there is a hidden side to this story that has not been revealed yet, neither by the Israelis nor by the Egyptians. But what we understand from the statements we've been getting from both sides, there was an exchange of fire. There were a number of people killed, but whether or not the firing came from the drug smugglers, no one is pretty sure about that. And the statements coming from the Israeli side and also from the Egyptians saying that there are investigations underway and both sides are cooperating to find out more about what happened. But whether or not that will be revealed to the public, we have no answer to that. But it's also worth highlighting that although Egypt has signed a peace treaty with Israel, Israel among the Egyptian public is still regarded as an enemy. And on social media, many have been referring to this Egyptian security personnel who lost his life on the border today as a martyr.
Sally Nabil in Cairo. Sudan's National Museum in Khartoum boasts one of the most comprehensive collections of African art and archaeology in the world. But with the capital scarred by 7 weeks of fighting between two army factions, fears are growing for the safety of the artefacts on display, as I heard from our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton.
The paramilitary, the RSF, entered the building and took control on Friday, and there are fears that they will carry out looting and vandalism. One RSF officer took to Facebook saying, "We're protecting it," but we're not sure whether to believe that. As you say, it has priceless relics like embalmed mummies dating back to 2,500 BC, statues, figurines, pottery, murals from ancient Nubia and the kingdom of Kush, which was around 1,000 BC. Then it has relics from Greek, Christian, Coptic, Islamic era, and even parts of Egyptian temples that were recovered from the Aswan Dam. And they're in the garden of the museum. So, as you say, completely priceless relics.
Of course, Khartoum has been at the centre of the fighting in Sudan for weeks. Do we know how much damage, if any, has been done to the museum already?
That's difficult to say because the museum staff, as soon as the conflict broke out, they stopped working there and also the security guards left. Although one Sudanese artist said he'd been trapped inside the building for 2 weeks and had to live off water and artists' materials and some lemons. And there is video footage of ancient skeletons being opened from their coffins or boxes, and the RSF guards saying that these skeletons are the victims of previous leader Omar al-Bashir, but that's clearly not the case because these skeletons are thought to be thousands of years old. This footage has not been verified by the BBC, I must say, but it's been seen by the news website called Middle East Eye, which has described it as the night of the living dead. So it feels like that it's like the Taliban or ISIS in terms of destroying cultural relics.
Now, there have been numerous efforts to arrange ceasefires in Sudan. What is the latest on the fighting?
The ceasefires have sort of turned out to be meaningless. There were blasts heard today. Witnesses talked of bombs falling and civilians being injured. The Red Crescent has had to bury about 180 unidentified bodies. And there are also reports that the national broadcaster has been interrupted. So that's another key target in this conflict.
Our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton. The past month has seen Russia launch air attacks on Ukraine almost every other day. But according to Vladimir Putin, it is the West and not Russia that is the aggressor, and that NATO hopes to destroy Russia. But do ordinary Russians actually believe that? Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg travelled 240 kilometres from Moscow to the town of Yaroslavl to find out.
Life in Russia right now feels rather surreal. In Yaroslavl, there are children singing pop songs, people dancing, balloons and candy floss. It's the annual City Day celebration. War? What war? And then reality hits. Walk past the drummers in Jubilee Park and you're reminded of the special military operation, Russia's war in Ukraine. Volunteers have set up stalls here. Armed with needle and thread, they're making battlefield camouflage for Russian soldiers in Ukraine. Balaclavas and socks too, even stretchers. They believe the Kremlin narrative that the war in Ukraine is not Russia's fault. Russians never hurt anyone until someone hurts them. One of the volunteers, a teacher called Yelena, tells me, "The Russian bear won't hurt you if you don't threaten him. That's the golden rule." Once upon a time, the Russian bear viewed the West as friend, not foe. In the centre of Yaroslavl, there's a small commemorative stone. The Rock of Friendship, they call it. Listed here are the names of Yaroslavl's twin towns, like Exeter, Burlington, Virginia, and Poitiers, though some of these have suspended ties over the war in Ukraine. Now, a local activist, Sergei Kazansky, is campaigning to have the Rock of Friendship removed. Carved into this rock, Sergei tells me, are twin towns from countries that are now Russia's enemies because they are supporting Ukraine and supplying it with weapons. If the West didn't help Ukraine, the conflict would have been over long ago. But then I ask passers-by what they think about the idea of removing the monument. Listen to what they tell me. No, leave it where it is, says Gleb. History shouldn't be touched. It's wrong to remove monuments, Lilia says. We need to find a common language with each other. We shouldn't break off relations completely, says Mikhail. This will be over soon, and all countries will reconcile. City Day ends with a firework display. The cheering crowd, a stark contrast to the horrors of war. So what do I make of everything I've seen and heard in Yaroslavl? It's true that many Russians do accept what state TV tells them, that the West is to blame for everything. But not everyone here believes that, or wants a rupture with Europe and America. Nevertheless, the invasion of Ukraine will have long-term consequences for Russia and for its relationship with the West.
Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg. There was a lot of history being made at the FA Cup final here in London on Saturday afternoon. It was the first ever between Manchester City and Manchester United. It was the second stage of a possible treble for the Premier League champion City, and it saw an incredibly fast goal, as I heard from Lee James at Wembley Stadium.
Breathtaking start for Pep Guardiola's team, wasn't it? It was the City captain Ilkay Gundogan who was the match winner, ensuring his place in history with the quickest goal in FA Cup final history. His stunning volley came after just 12 seconds. Manchester United, despite City's dominance, did equalise from the penalty spot after 33 minutes when the video assistant referee ruled that Jack Grealish had handled the ball. Bruno Fernandes scored from the spot. But Gundogan wasn't to be denied. He made the decisive contribution following Kevin De Bruyne's free kick just into the second half to give City the win. They lift the FA Cup for the seventh time. Gundogan lifted that trophy and the City captain said the early goal was a pleasant surprise.
We aim for that, you know, to go long for Erling and then to get the second ball and try to attack quick. I guess it's for the first time this season we've scored. The ball just was placed amazingly for me and I just had to hit it. Obviously, it was quite a good strike and it went in and it was amazing.
So disappointment for Manchester United as they weren't able to stop their rivals, potentially matching their treble achievement, but overall an improving season.
Yes, I think it will be when they reflect. Obviously, it's ended in bitter disappointment today with a cup final defeat to their neighbours. That'll be very hard to take for Erik ten Hag's side. But they did lift the League Cup, United's first trophy in 6 years. They have returned to the Champions League after finishing third in the Premier League this season. Let's hear from him today, though, after the defeat, proud of his team's efforts.
Once again, this team showed resilience, character, they have the personality. And we know we have a way to go, but this make us better was the test. Yeah, we didn't succeed, but I think we can take a lot of positives with us to the next season.
So Manchester City the winners today, Oliver, and there could be still more to come, of course. They face Internazionale in the Champions League final next Saturday, and Sports World will come live from Istanbul.
Lee James at Wembley Stadium in London. And still to come on the Global News podcast.
When the Epsom Derby was being run, police were lining the railings. You wouldn't see that normally at a horse race. And men wearing top hats were asked to take them off so stewards could check nothing was being hidden underneath.
Why was there so much security at one of the world's most famous horse races? The Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has long been criticised for his unorthodox economic policies, lowering rather than raising interest rates to tackle inflation. But after being sworn in as president for a third term, he has signalled a possible change of direction by naming a traditional economist, Mehmet Şimşek, as finance minister. He's also appointed Hakan Fidan, the former intelligence chief, as the new foreign minister. Following his narrow and bitterly fought election win last week, Mr. Erdogan called for unity after his inauguration.
Turkey needs the energy, ideas and contributions of every citizen. All members of Turkey's 85 million population should stick together, just like bricks forming a wall. Turkey needs unity and solidarity more than ever. As a nation, we need to re-establish our strong unity.
Alex Ritson asked Berge Şimşek from the BBC Turkish service if the finance minister's appointment had been a surprise.
This has been talked about for the past couple of days, but it is a surprise in the sense that it marks a departure from years of unorthodox economic policies under Erdogan, because lately Erdogan has been in favor of lowering the interest rates, saying that if we lower the interest rates, we will bring more investment to the country, and then it will basically create more job opportunities. But it's
which is the exact opposite of the way most economists see it, isn't it?
Exactly. And it proved wrong. So it means that the new finance minister will probably make a U-turn from this policy, because he is not as someone who is in favor of rising the interest rates. And he is actually highly regarded by investors. He had been a finance minister before and deputy prime minister between 2009 and 2018. So he is not someone foreign to investors.
Berger Simcek of the BBC Turkish service. Tests are being carried out in Mexico on 45 bags of human remains recently found in a ravine outside the western city of Guadalajara. They were discovered as part of a search for seven call centre workers who'd been reported missing. Patrick McDonnell is Mexico City Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke to Julian Warica.
It's a very complicated and obviously tragic and sad case, but it seems like eight in total, we're told now, six young men, two young women, all in their 20s and 30s, had jobs in what they call a call center, which are very popular in Mexico, especially among young people who speak some English. They told their family they were helping foreigners buy vacation homes. But it turns out, allegedly, it was part of a broader scam that happens quite a bit in Mexico of organized crime, essentially trying to rip off foreigners who try to buy vacation homes or so-called timeshares in resort properties in Mexico. The place had been functioning in clandestine fashion since November. Something went wrong in May, and one by one, these young people tragically started disappearing. Their families reported them, and no one knew what was going on until a couple of days ago, some butchered bodies showed up in 45 plastic bags in a ravine outside of Guadalajara, which is close to where they were working. And authorities are still working on identifying whom those remains belong to, but District Attorney in Guadalajara has already said that they appear to be the remains of those eight missing young people who were working at that call center.
Which is the most grisly of discoveries. What's been the local reaction to something like this?
You know, it's Mexico. Lamentably, there's a lot of something like 115,000 disappeared people. Guadalajara is in the state of Jalisco, which is a kind of a leader in this, lamentably. So, of course, there have been protests, which have coincided with other street protests for other disappeared people. You know, Guadalajara is the second city of Mexico. It's a major cultural and economic hub. Tomorrow, there's an opening of an international film festival there, which draws thousands of people from all over the world. It's a very sophisticated city, and yet these things happen alongside that daily life. It's certainly shocking.
I think what people listening might be puzzled over is the idea that a group of young people who are doing an innocent job like working in a call centre find themselves caught up in something linked to organised crime with this horrific ending.
You're absolutely right. Stunned us all. But, I mean, as the details came out, it was a clandestine call centre. It was allegedly connected to organised crime, including a very important mob, which generates a lot of funds, apparently, from these kinds of scams in which they call up people, many of them in the United States, and basically tell them that their timeshare needs to be sold, or there's a renter, or they manage to extort a lot of money out of people from telephone scams.
The wider picture in Mexico, I mean, the figures are extraordinary. More than 100,000 official disappearances. It seems to be a problem on an enormous scale that the authorities simply can't successfully tackle.
It's so true. You know, I worked for a time in Buenos Aires and after the dirty war there, but they had figures of up to 30,000 people disappeared. Those were largely political disappearances. Here it's organized crime, but the scope here is such that it's become such a normal thing to find clandestine graves with a few or a dozen or several score people that it often doesn't merit much of a headline. It speaks, frankly, to the lack of control that the government has over much of the country due to organized crime.
Patrick McDonnell, Mexico City Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Now, could this be an important step in the battle against plastic pollution? Representatives from 175 countries have agreed to draw up the first draft of a global treaty by November. Plastic waste is expected to almost triple by 2060, while plastic debris is estimated to kill more than 1 million seabirds and 100,000 sea mammals every year. Andrew Ocheng has details of the talks in Paris.
I see no objection. It is so decided.
Just getting to the point where countries could agree to put together a draft treaty wasn't easy. The first 2 days of the talks were dominated by debates about procedure, fueled largely by fossil fuel supplier Saudi Arabia and major plastic producers like China and India. But on Friday, the countries agreed that the treaty should be drafted by November, ahead of a third round of talks in Kenya next year. It's hoped it will be a legally binding instrument which will help curb plastic pollution across the world. Negotiators and activists say there is no time to waste given the current state of the problem. The UN says plastic debris is estimated to kill more than 1 million seabirds and 100,000 marine mammals each year. Here is Camila Zepeda, a negotiator from Mexico.
We see that the trend is by 2050 there will be more plastic rubbish than fish in the ocean, and that therefore we have to take international action to solve the issue.
In humans, microscopic pieces of plastic have been detected in blood, breast milk and placentas. Worse still, just less than 10% of it is recycled and more than a fifth dumped or banned illegally. Erik Lindebjerg from the environmental group WWF is hoping for a comprehensive draft.
We believe that an ambitious treaty needs to have global bans and phase-outs of the most high-risk and harmful plastic products. And finally, we think that the treaty must include a strong financial mechanism to support developing countries in implementing the treaty.
The negotiators hope the treaty will be signed in early 2025.
A report by Andrew Ochieng. One of the world's most famous horse races, the Epsom Derby, has passed off largely without incident, despite the threat of disruption by animal rights activists. The BBC's John Hunt was commentating at the finish line.
King of Steel hits the front, chased by one of the favourites, August Rodin. King of Steel, August Rodin, though, is moving into top gear. They have come about 8 lengths clear of White Bird, staying on in third. What a battle to the line! August Rodin just getting on top. August Rodin won the Derby for Aidan O'Brien and rider Ryan Moore.
A huge security operation had been put in place at the course south of London to deal with any potential problems, as Charlotte Gallagher explained.
We saw what happened at the Grand National in April. Activists got onto the course and they delayed the start of the race. So organisers here managed to get an injunction, but some activists said they were willing to break the law. One man managed to climb over the railings and was on the course when the race started. The Jockey Club, which owns this racecourse, has said that was incredibly dangerous. The group behind that protest, Animal Rising, they've said he was on the track before it started and they allowed the race to start when he was there. So they're blaming the organisers of the Epsom Derby. Obviously, there has been loads of police. When the Epsom Derby was being run, for example, police were lining the railings. You wouldn't see that normally at a horse race. And men wearing top hats, when they got to the racecourse, were asked to take them off so stewards could check nothing was being hidden underneath. This group, Animal Rising, says horse racing is incredibly cruel. They don't believe animals should be used for sport, should be used for entertainment. Horse racing officials say they've spent millions and millions of dollars protecting horse welfare, and they say the sport has never been safer. But if you do look at the Grand National, 3 horses died during that race, and that's what animal rights campaigners point to, and they say 1 fatality is too many, let alone 3 in 1 race.
And then what of the race itself?
Today was a goodbye to Epsom from Frankie Dettori, one of the most famous jockeys in the world. He was aiming for his 3rd win in the Epsom Derby. Sadly for him, it wasn't to be. Instead, Ryan Moore clinched his 3rd race, the jockey, the 3rd victory for him. Aidan O'Brien, the Irish trainer, broke his own record, won it for the 9th time. The horse, August Rodin, apparently is going home back to the stables for some extra hay tonight.
Charlotte Gallagher at the Epsom Derby, south of London. The Nigerian singer Burna Boy has become the first African artist to headline a concert in a British stadium. The Grammy Award-winning star played to a packed-out crowd at the Olympic Park in East London. It's the latest example of how Afrobeats and other African music have won new fans around the world. Eddie Caddy, who presents the official UK Afrobeats chart show on BBC Radio 1 Extra, spoke to Caroline Wyatt.
African music has always been popular. I feel like this is maybe the second or third cycle. You know, if you go back to the ages of Fela Kuti, who was noted to be collaborating with people like Paul McCartney, Franco from TPOK Jazz. This is not the first time African music has been at the forefront. Now, what's happening with social media and how the world is so vastly connected, the young Africans have decided to actually infuse R&B music, hip-hop music, jazz, and all types of music from the West as well to create this new genre. And, of course, also, when we look at diasporans that have grown outside of the continent, in America, here in the UK, all the way down to Australia, they've been able to play a great part in actually making sure that African music has become part of the culture where they're actually living right now. Currently, we're looking at Burna Boy, who's the first African artist to sell out a stadium here in the UK. You know, these are some of the big names, but we also go to South Africa and we're looking at some of the biggest names when it comes to the amapiano scene, in Moussa Keys, who's probably got arguably one of the biggest Afrobeat songs right now called Unavailable with Davido. We've recently seen Tiwa Savage. Tiwa Savage has done something amazing at the King's Coronation. And that's a homegrown talent from the UK, grew up in Northwest London, and has gone over to take over the world. The list goes on and on and on.
And also gaining recognition, like winning awards.
Absolutely gaining recognition. I mean, we recently looked at the Grammy Awards with the one and only Burna Boy. Wizkid recently before that best video with Beyonce. She says she really grew up poor like me. Don't believe in nothing but the Almighty. Just a little jeans and a pure whitey. And then we're talking about recognition. We look at someone who's now become a prominent part of the charts in Libyanka and her song People, which has been a lot of people's favourites. I walked in the room, eyes are red, and I don't smoke banga. Libyanka resides in America but comes from Cameroon, another region where great music is coming out of as well. And these artists are going around the world literally just collecting recognitions because the music is really where it's supposed to be, at the top. Young Rema, who's just also done a sellout tour in India. Who would have thought that Afrobeats would be selling out in India? You know, he's number one in Saudi Arabia, going all the way to China. When we look at Remy's song Calm Down, Selena Gomez comes into the remix with that song and takes it to another level. Breaking records all over the world. And I think this is just the tip of the iceberg. We've really just started to see where Afrobeats or African music in general can go, because the music hasn't got limits in terms of the style. I think everybody would like everyone to know that there is more to African music than just Afrobeats.
Eddie Caddy on the rise of Afrobeats. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast very soon. This one was mixed by Daphith Evans and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.